welcome to another edition of Turned Out a Punk. I'm your host, Damien Abraham. Once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, huge one, huge guest. I even say it to him. I think he's one of the most important artists of the last half of the last century, this first part of the century. Steve-O from Jackass is here on the show today. That's right. And this one, oh God, this goes deep. This is awesome. Get ready. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham, and he will get the message to me. He also runs a Facebook page and an Instagram page at Turned Out a Punk. I believe it's both of those on those things as well. So you can find him there. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Left4Damien. If you want to support the show, the best way to support the show is just by telling all your friends about it, letting everyone know that you know that we do this podcast. And sometimes it's like a legendary musician. Sometimes it's Steve-O from Jackass. Sometimes it's, you know, just tell them we got a lot of cool people on here. Just let them know. You can also support the show by heading over to patreon.com/turnedoutapunk. And thank you to all the people that do that as well. And speaking of support, this show would not be possible without the kind, loving support of the fine folks at Vans, who came aboard a few years ago and said, Damien, do what you do, just don't do it out of your own pocket. And they helped me cover the cost of this thing, and it's been fantastic. So thank you to Vans for everything they do. You can also support this podcast by subscribing to it and rating it on your platform of choice. If you're looking for something fun to watch visually on the internet, you can check out floodmagazine.com/, well, just floodmagazine.com, and look over there for Punk as Fuck, which is a series of videos I did with them a few years ago where I went around Los Angeles and celebrated punk. What else do I do? And finally, Fucked Up has put out our final installment of Year of the Horse. That's right. The final chapter is out. The big conclusion. It's an hour and a half long. You can check it out over there on the Fucked Up Bandcamp. I think you'll dig it. Julian Baker's on this last part. Matt from the Nationals on it as well. Lots of other cool guests. Really proud of this thing. A lot of people worked on it. I'm just like one small component of a much, much greater group effort. So please check that out over there. It takes an hour and a half. So get comfortable. Bring a book. I didn't read the lyrics. There's a lot of good lyrics for that thing. All right. On to today's show. Today on the show, a legend. I call him an artist, and I really do believe he is one of the most important performance artists ever, but one of the most important artists certainly of the last, you know, few decades. Steve-O from Jackass. Steve-O, I don't know. There's just so, where do you even start by explaining Steve-O? Steve-O became famous. How do you not know this? But by hurting himself as part of Jackass and really catapulted to international stardom. He was on Dancing with the Stars, you know? This is a guy who got on network TV by inflicting immense amount of pain on himself. And of course, that's a massive simplification because there's also a lot of charisma involved. And just, you know, the Jackass phenomena is fascinating to me. If you want to hear me, you know, wax more poetically about it, go back and listen to the Danger Aaron episode. Anyway, Fort Bragg Magazine Instagram account posted this photo of Steve-O wearing a Gorilla Biscuit shirt. And this was something that I think I saw back in the day on you know, a message board. But they reposted it recently on their Instagram account. And I saw this thing and I hit up Tristan and I'm like, you know what? We got to take a shot at Steve-O and see what's up. And oh my gosh, did I not know where this thing would go. This goes, Steve-O's got great taste. You know, he's got great taste. I don't want to spoil anything for you. This one's going to be coming up in a second. That's it. I don't really think there's anything more to tell you about this thing. No real notes to get to that I can see here. Steve-O over there at steveo.com has released a brand new special called Gnarly. It's a comedy special with lots of stunts. The stuff I've seen from this thing, it looks very, very nuts. Very, very nuts. He is a extreme performer to say the least. If you are a fan of Steve-O, you will love this thing. And it's watchable online. You can go watch it online right now. They're also working on Jackass 4. He's got lots of products for sale on this website, too. So he's writing a new book. Anyway, you'll hear about a lot of this stuff in the episode. There's a brief cameo at the very, very end, too. You'll hear that. Okay, that's it. All right, sit back, relax, and enjoy Steve-O on Turned Out a Punk. Steve-O, thank you so much for coming on the show.
After I flaked on you.
Well,
but sure.
Well, it is worth it to talk to you because I think you are one of the most influential artists of recent memory, certainly of my lifetime.
Wow, that's high praise, man. I'll take it.
Well, we'll get into all of that. I think we've got a lot of stuff to talk about today, including both being the progeny of parents that worked for PepsiCo.
Oh, wow. How about that?
Well, we got to start this off the way they all start off, which is, Steve-O, how did you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across the genre?
Let's see here. It started with metal. I feel compelled to share my first experience there. I believe I was in a Woolworths. It was a department store in London, England, and the cover of Iron Maiden's The Number of the Beast caught my eye.
Mm-hmm.
I knew nothing about it. I just knew that album cover looked so cool. And so I bought that. I often say it was that first Iron Maiden album that taught me I was a metalhead. And that was when I was 10. And then my first Motley Crue album taught me why I was a metalhead. You know, it was like they just were having so much fun, it seemed like. The sex and drugs and rock and roll, like, you know, really, that was when I was 11. I think I started aspiring to partying like Motley Crue one way or another. And then I say that when I was 12, my first Slayer album taught me really how bad the situation is. It seemed like there was a progression there. Moving on from the heavy metal obsession, skateboarding became my identity. And I really mean like my identity. I think that like being always super uncomfortable in my own skin one way or another, which, you know, I know is a trait of alcoholism. Mm-hmm. I was just an uncomfortable kid. I just felt defective somehow. Like I wasn't enough. And so I always wanted to find some identity to really latch on to. And at first it was Little League sports. And I would be just roaming around on days when I wasn't like playing a game, but wearing my full uniform, like, because that made me feel, you know, and then that uniform that which represented my identity that I clung to turned into the heavy metal with the mullet and the, you know, the jean jacket with the patches on it and stuff. And then coming out of the heavy metal phase, it my identity became that of a skateboarder. And so very much what introduced me to punk music was skateboarding. I was 13 at this point. My family moved back to London, England. And there was just this little record store around the corner. And God, I just can't even remember which album. I remember like the first sort of batch of albums. I mean, there was Misfits, Legacy of Brutality.
Mm-hmm.
That represented the shift. I ended up getting every Misfits album by the time I was 14, or when I was 14. There was SNFU.
Canadian content.
Yeah, Canadian. There are a few Canadian bands I got really into. The Dayglo Abortions.
Yes.
God, I love the Dayglo Abortions. Okay, what else was there? Early on, Youth Brigade was a big one. 7 Seconds. So that all, like, you know, and I really do feel that I associated all of that with as like, I probably would have called it skate music, you know, like not even understanding that it was punk. You know, it was like really just my affiliation with the skateboard community. I felt like that this music represented. There was also the Suicidal Tendencies. The Sex Pistols was sort of in that bag. And this is the music that got me through 8th and 9th grade. But during the summer, I want to say, yeah, the summer between 9th and 10th grade, this is when one of my buddies, who I really just felt was such a cool kid, he was better at skateboarding. He had like just this attitude of supreme confidence, and his taste in music, I just, he could listen to whatever, and I would have just, I just thought this guy Franz was so cool, and he was listening to some straight edge hardcore, which and I think the first band was the Gorilla Biscuits, and man, as soon as I heard that first Gorilla Biscuits EP with Big Mouth on it, I mean, I was hook, line, and sinker with that.
That's so awesome.
So of course, this is so funny too. Of course, like not very long after hearing that first Gorilla Biscuits EP, I immediately needed to buzz my head and take a big marker and draw X's on my hands to go skateboarding around.
Yeah, as one does, absolutely.
Right. Like, I mean, it's pretty funny, like, what a, like, pitiful, like, little, you know, that was just that, it was just pitiful, like, how much I just needed to latch on to things as, you know.
But what a positive thing for you to find, you know, like, as a kid searching for something. Like, I've always felt that about straight edge. Like, it's never going to be for everyone, you know, or anything like that. But at the same time, you know, and it's not going to be something that's for life for everyone, but like, it's such a positive thing for kids to find, where it's telling you, like, you know what, you don't need drugs and alcohol. You don't need to listen to what people are telling you around you. You can be yourself.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, definitely listening to straight edge hardcore music did not do any harm to me in any way. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of good messaging in that. The thing was, though, it wasn't, you know, like now I was living in London, England all through high school. And like I said, I got in 10th grade, was like super skateboarding and straight edge hardcore. And by the end of during the summer between 10th grade and 11th grade, the last of the skateboarders left my school, which was the American school in London. Mm-hmm. You know, I went to this super privileged, you know, I went to school with the American ambassador to England's son, and like all these diplomatic kids and super, you know, business corporate kids, you know, of which I was one. And, you know, I was just too insecure of a kid to be the only skater. There's no way that was going to work. So once the last other skateboarder moved away, I made very much consciously decided that my new identity was going to be that of a pothead. You know, I really did. And I hadn't, I'd never, nobody offered me pot. It wasn't like there was any peer pressure to get into it. You know, like I just decided that was going to be my next thing. And I went seeking it out. And as such, my musical tastes turned to the Grateful Dead and You know, it's so funny how with every little phase I went through, it came like a whole new sort of genre of music. And, you know, like in some respects, that's super embarrassing for me. But in other respects, I think that having an eclectic, well-rounded, diverse, you know, appetite for music is really, really helpful.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, so how do I see that? Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's you know, like people will ask me, what's my favorite kind of music? And my go-to answer is music is like food, and I don't always want to eat Twinkies.
Did you go to any shows during that year that you were kind of into all this stuff?
Sure, I did. I got to see the Gorilla Biscuits on their Start Today tour. It was, it was 1989. So like a fall of 1989. I got to see Rollins Band. I don't know how much that really fits in there.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, of course. Black Flag.
Yeah, for sure. I saw Verbal Assault.
Oh, amazing.
There was a point when I was in, I went to Washington, D.C. area a couple of summers and was able to catch shows at the Safari Club when I was just 15 years old. 15, I was excited to see Gut Instinct play there.
Are you fucking kidding me? You saw Gut Instinct?
Yeah, I saw Gut Instinct. And they remain on my iPod to this day.
Absolutely. One of the hardest bands ever.
Yeah, fuck yeah. Dude, which brings to mind more bands. Outburst was really great. Killing Time. I really like Killing Time.
Incredible.
I guess it fits into the straight edge more, but not New York straight edge. A band called Side by Side.
They were New York too. Absolutely.
Oh, they were New York. Okay, well, shows that I know. Oh, dude, how did I forget Youth of Today? They were a huge staple.
Absolutely. Did you see them? Because they did a European tour, I think, around there too, right?
Yeah, I did not. Okay. I did not. I think I could believe that I would have been intimidated to go to a Youth of Today show. you know, there's something more lighthearted about the Gorilla Biscuits and something a little bit intimidating about, you know, like the suggestion of violence, you know, for like the whole bold, you know, and Youth of Today, like, your eyes are red and I'll kick your ass.
I really do think in the the broad light of today, Gut Instinct is definitely a much more harder show experience than the Youth of the Day show would have been.
Yeah, like, you know what? That is a very fair point. It's a very, very fair point.
That's awesome. So were there any bands in the UK that you saw? Like I mean local wise.
Bands from the UK.
I'm trying to think who would have been around then. I guess Leatherface would have been starting to get going. Jail Cell Recipes.
I remember that these names don't ring a bell, but a band that was, I believe, fairly local. And I didn't see them live, but I just saw them. They're being pushed pretty hard by that local record store. It was a band called Bolt Thrower.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, for sure. They ended up doing a whole record themed around Warhammer 40K.
Nice. Okay.
they're also a sort of a legendary hard band. They kind of transition more into sort of the world of like death metal and become kind of like foundational to that too. But
now the label that would represent that sort of a bridge would be Alternative Tentacles. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, I think Earache over there in the UK would have been kind of like they would have been putting out Napalm Death and Carcass,
right, okay,
and Bolt Thrower later on as well. But yeah, certainly Alternative Tentacles had like a I guess a weirder roster by that point, you know, like it's the Dead Kennedys label, but yeah. By then it was like Alice Donut and I'm trying to think Ultra Bidet and No Means No.
Logical Nonsense got yes. signed to yes. Alternative Tentacles. They were out of Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I lived in Albuquerque and knew those guys.
Whoa, that's awesome.
Fucking Logical Nonsense is not on my iPod these days. I'm just realizing sometimes that, you know, like, hey, this is something that I really, really love and don't do enough. But like, whenever I can like dedicate myself to just sinking my teeth into one album and just listening to it on repeat over and over and over, I feel that I'm really like fusing whatever like moment in my life, which I'm living, like I'm bonding it to that music. And as a result, by having my iPod on shuffle, like it'll just take me on this crazy time traveling experience, you know, like the way that when we hear music from the past, it conjures up like real emotions, like real feelings. And, you know, like I'm always trying to think of like music that I can dig up from my past that that I don't have in my library that can evoke that like sort of time traveling of you know that evoke those old feelings because it's so real, you know. And to do that with Logical Nonsense would take me right back to those to you know those late 90s. And those were really particularly special times. I love that you're aware of Logical Nonsense. Fuck, they're great.
I should, you know, I'm sure I've got some Logical Nonsense records on vinyl, but I, you know what? This show is really good at tracking down things like that for people. So if these get passed on to me, I will make sure they come to you. But like you're saying, there's something about physical format where you would spend time with a record that I think that's one of the things that's lost now. Like, obviously we have everything at our disposal, which is incredible. But at the same time, you don't really, I find, get bonded to things in the same way that you did when you kind of had that one thing that you're listening to over and over again, like you're saying.
Right. Yes. And in some ways too, probably much less so, but like the way that our devices, which, you know, if it's an iPhone, if it's an iPod, if it's just like, you know, the car stereo, like via Bluetooth, the way that it you know, labels every track, I think that we're more aware of track names today than we were back in those days, because sure, we would read the lyrics and the album sleeve, maybe we, but we wouldn't like, you know, like I noticed that recently. I thought, man, I'm aware of song names more than I think I used to be.
Yeah, I guess you'd be more aware of the album title and then you just kind of digest it as a complete piece.
Right. Uh-huh.
Unless you're making a mixtape, I guess that would be the only time you'd really break it up into those individual tracks, but then it's normally like one song that you kind of fixate on.
So I remember going on tour in 2014 in Australia, and we had this hysterical tour manager who was assigned to us, and us being me and my tour manager, Scott Randall. Okay. And this guy, you know, picks us up. It's his job to get us to the shows around Australia. And the first time we got in the car with them, I synced up my Bluetooth to the rental van. And like the first thing that came out of my iPod was Slayer. And this guy's, oh, we're going to get along great. You know, but my iPod being so diverse, like maybe the next thing that came out was like the fucking Thompson Twins or something, you know. And he's like, what the fuck is this? And we got into like talking about the you know, tastes in music, and this guy says, I said, oh, I listen to all kinds of, he goes, yeah, I listen to all kinds of metal. All kinds of metal. And I just think of that because I wonder, like, how are you like pretty religious to punk music?
Well, I think to me, the thing about punk that's incredible is that there is no sonic template. Like on this show, I've had people from the Go-Go's on, people from the B-52s on, people from Agnostic Front on, people from Black Flag on, people from the Gorilla Biscuits on.
Like, oh, how about Madball? I'd love to dig up Madball. I don't think.
Oh, they're definitely still going. They just played a show today or yesterday.
Oh yeah, and that wasn't Madball. Like, if I understood the myth of the band was that the lead singer of Agnostic Front was in jail for some reason, and the little brother of the singer of Agnostic Front took over, and that was like how Madball came to be.
Yeah, like Freddie used to get up at Agnostic Front shows and just and get the mic from Roger and just sing, because he was going to Agnostic Front shows since he was like probably like 4 or 5 years old type thing. So he knew all the words, so he would get up. And so at a certain point, yeah, they just did a 7-inch Ball of Destruction with Freddie fronting Agnostic Front. And then over time, you know, the Madball develops its own lineup and very much is a monster unto itself. Like, they are definitely, I think, probably the kings of New York, I'd say.
I can recall there being like a self-titled track, Madball, that was just, that I think I even tried to dig up at some point and couldn't pursue it. You know, maybe that's just I didn't look very hard, but Madball. Whether it's even the title of the track, I'm not sure, but I just remember like this kid just screaming Madball in some like mosh pit part of the song that was just super intense.
Yeah, no, Freddie's definitely a hard vocalist. I think some of their stuff, most of their stuff is on streaming services, but maybe not the first two singles. But, you know, they're still going strong. We actually went on tour with them a couple years ago in Australia in the band I play in, and really cool to be on tour with them, but definitely like a different presence than, you know, any of the other bands on tour, any of the metal bands or pop punk bands on tour.
Oh yeah. How about Bad Brains? They were a big part of my ninth grade.
One of the greatest bands ever. Absolutely. 100%.
Yeah. And then there's the tune, Sacred Love. And I recall the myth being that HR was in jail and recorded the song over the phone from jail, which was supposedly testimony to like what an incredible you know, sense of rhythm, and because on his end he had no musical track, but even the lyrics of the song Sacred Love indicate it's about a guy in jail. He says, I'm in here, you're out there, you know, like, but that's not the case, huh? So why was that track recorded over the phone, right? Like, what,
Wasn't he in prison when it was recorded? I thought he was.
I'd be really interested to find out, because I believe that at some point I dug into that a little bit and learned that he wasn't.
I always heard that rumor too, and I've never, to be honest with you, dug into it very
deep. I think it's worth digging into it, dude. I think we got to find out. I think that was just an artistic liberty right there.
You know what? It's like that John Ford thing where you just sometimes just go with the legend, you know, just right. Help build that myth.
Yeah, for sure.
Which is funny, because like, and here's where I'll kind of make the first analogy, I guess, to what you do as a performer. It's punk rock for the most part is about tearing down a lot of that edifice that goes into like making sort of these rock band myths, you know, and it's about sort of exposing the reality and kind of, I think, what you do as a performer, it's like the probably the most real performance that there is.
Right. You know? Yeah. I mean, and I feel compelled to thank you for the kind words. So thank you. I think also that like in my career is really based on like a saying, like video or it didn't happen. You know, I'd be like, you just don't even bother making claims unless there's video to back it up. And that's kind of like proved to be my little my angle on my new career in stand-up comedy. Mm-hmm. Because for all of the, you know, the fictional stories that stand-up comedians sort of spin, I don't do any of that. And, you know, like, and now, like, I did this last comedy special where, like, my head exploded when I came up with the idea to be telling these utterly insane stories with all the jokes mixed into the act, but actually also edit into it the video footage of the stories unfolding. Mm-hmm. And so I made this like crazy, like super explicit multimedia comedy special, which I called Gnarly. And I stream it from my website, stevo.com. And it's so funny because you have to click to indicate that you're over 18 years old just to see the trailer, because it's like I've really leaned into making it super, super fucked up. But yeah, and then in following up the Gnarly special, I decided I didn't want to tell any old stories anymore. I wanted to create new ones because, you know, I don't want to turn into the guy talking about what he could bench press in high school, you know. and so, yeah, now I got my bucket list tour and it's very much that.
It's funny because like when Aaron was on the podcast, he kind of talked about how much like the physical toll of what you guys do weighs on him. Like, do you feel
you mean
too?
Danger Aaron McGeehee?
Yes. Yeah.
Super cool, man. And I want to say it's about 1 week ago, he became a father for the first time.
That is incredible. I knew him for years just as a guy who would come to our shows and take photos and then never made the connection that he was Danger Aaron until one day I'm just talking to him backstage and it just all clicks. And I'm like, holy fuck, you're the dude from Jackass.
Yeah.
He's like, yeah, yeah. Just like, he is, yeah, an amazing dude, very unassuming. So congratulations to him on becoming a father.
For sure. Yeah, I love him, man. He's probably the most well-adjusted, like, you know, the of all the guys. I think that while fame is not something that anybody is really seems to be trying to trade in, you know, I think as unhealthy as fame is, I don't think there's anything healthy about it. But like, you know, there's some real perks to it. And I think that Danger Aaron would have to be like the least affected by the spotlight.
It was fascinating talking to him and finding about, like, you know, growing up with, you know, obviously the parents in the funeral industry and just seeing how that affected him. And like somehow it weirdly, I guess it also kind of grounds him.
I suppose so. Yeah. I recently had Danger Aaron on my podcast and, you know, I just kind of got into it and said like, hey man, you know, like you've always been sort of like a whipping boy on Jackass. It's like, people just essentially bullying you, you know, and I've never really liked that. I haven't like much participated in it or approved of it. And
it's funny you bring that up. Lance Bangs, when he was on the podcast, really talked about that, like talked about how much bullying and kind of hazing went on in Jackass stuff. And just how like it, like you're saying, it's definitely something where I know it reminds me so much of pro wrestling, like what you guys do. And it's even more intensified than pro wrestling, because in pro wrestling, there's still that edifice of character that they kind of hide behind, where it's you guys, it's just bone on bone reality. And I can only imagine what that kind of does, you know, mentally and just kind of creates a sort of locker room situation.
Yeah. I mean, if anybody deserves to be bullied and abused, I would say it was me. You know, like I was always so just plain difficult to be around that I don't know,
like I think the you know, there's that thing Boonwell, and there's all this thing about documentary and how fake documentary is like a type of film, because the reality is you're dressing up reality. And I really think that you guys were making pure documentary. Like what you guys were doing was like very, like it's kind of like, it obviously owes a lot to performance art in not sort of a direct way, I'm sure. But like, I think just like what you're doing, but also it's bringing it to a new, it's like the Mondo film. It's just so many things going on in what you're kind of creating.
I'm just still stuck on your take on documentaries, and I'm kind of trying to break down that thought a little bit, or at least my interpretation of it. And I think that, yeah, like, you can certainly make documentaries to create a narrative, you know, as we see all the time, and really, really influence people in a big way. Mm-hmm. That's why YouTube can be just so crazy scary. And it's probably, you know, I wonder how much YouTube and social media in general has to do with how divided the world is today, because it is so easy to create a narrative that's, you know, it seems very real and is very persuasive.
Oh yeah, like we've had a complete breakdown in, you know, and there was obviously faults with the mainstream media, you know, as such, but there's now like, what is mainstream media? You know, and like what separates, you know, just some random person putting out a tweet from a legitimate news organization putting out a tweet. Right. Like, it's democratized completely.
Right. It's so crazy, man. But with that said, I wouldn't want to disparage documentary filmmaking as a whole. You know, like, I think that, and I'd say that as a guy who like virtually exclusively consumes nonfiction. I can bend my rules here and there, but I have very little interest in scripted movies. You know, I'm more into them if they're based on a true story. I've always felt that the world, there's so much interesting stuff to know. And, you know, like why do we spend so much time learning about shit that didn't even happen?
No, absolutely. Yeah. No, and I didn't mean to disparage documentary. Like, actually, I made a documentary about Darby Allin, the guy you've done work with.
Oh, cool.
You know, a couple years ago. But even there, I'm presenting a narrative to the audience. Right. You know, and I'm deciding what gets in and what gets left out from Darby's story.
Right. And let me not accuse you of disparaging documentary filmmaking. I think that's a step too far.
Okay.
But, you know, and I think that your point, you know, that it's really impossible to take complex sort of stories like histories and then condense them into, a limited time presentation, without leaving things out, without skewing the truth. And so your point is super valid. And then I think that what that took me to is like the cases where people are like really, really reckless about it. You know, like a great example of this whole using the power of persuasion afforded by documentary with the vegan community. Mm. It just drives me nuts how the vegan documentaries, there are some in particular that really like twist science, you know, like not like even just put fully factually wrong information like and put it forth as science. In the interest of promoting and spreading veganism. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that helps the movement. You know, I don't think that furthers the animal rights. I don't think that benefits animals to lie to people about food.
No, and, go on. Sorry.
I'm just like kind of complaining, but
no, I agree with you 100%. Like I just went vegan during this pandemic thing. And, you know, for me, like the largest thing that kind of kept me away from it, I think, was a lot of the stuff you're talking about. Just like a lot of people just, I don't know, like a lot of the disservice to veganism are sometimes other vegans, at least to me as someone who finally
came. Yeah, I mean, that's a whole other separate issue where if you're not vegan enough, you know, and it's like vegans attacking vegetarians, like vegans attacking pescatarians. Like, it's really pretty absurd. And what upset me the most was this documentary, because I was in it. You know, I was in it talking about, like, I was in the documentary talking about how I showed up to like a charity fundraiser thing to benefit the Diabetes Association. And I walked in and they were serving chicken. And I had like subscribed to all of this stuff that was in the vegan documentaries about how, you know, eating animal products clogs up your arteries or whatever, it causes cancer or like creates diabetes. And I, you know, threw a temper tantrum and stormed out of this diabetes event on the basis of them serving chicken there. And I said serving chicken at a diabetes event is like serving alcohol at an AA meeting, you know? I really think that was, you know, I drank the Kool-Aid, man, yeah. You know, I drank the Kool-Aid. And so then they put me in this documentary saying all that, which, you know, in and of itself might not have been too bad. But the problem was that the rest of the documentary, they were making these claims that sugar doesn't cause diabetes and eating animal products does. Like, you know, like, it was just outrageous claims. And if you look at, if you go on YouTube and search debunking what the health, that was the name of the documentary.
Yeah.
You just see a litany of videos from people saying, I'm a doctor and what the health is a bunch of bullshit. You know, like, I'm a vegan and what the health is a bunch of bullshit. And like, it drives me absolutely nuts that, like, you know, these people, you know, in their efforts to help the plight of animals, help animals, and like that they're doing this, but they're just taking all these steps backwards, because when people realize that they've been lied to, you know, that's not moving anything forward for animals.
Yeah. And that's the world we live in, is where you can kind of take, you know, it almost looks like you're an authority just because of the way things are packaged now when you make something. And that's the problem with documentaries. At the end of the day, it's just like everything, it's ultimately entertainment. And I think that's why what you guys do is so pure, because you're like, hey, I'm going to do this thing and it's going to really hurt. You do the thing and it really hurts, and we watch you do it. And I think there's just something that's just, there's nothing else that's kind of given to us that's like that in terms of culture, I guess.
Yeah. Well, hey man, thanks dude. I have all kinds of theories about how, you know, how Jackass is just really lightning in a bottle and something really special, you know, for how reckless and, you know, even like self-destructive, like at times we are. It's certainly irreverent. Like, you know, there's like in all of that, there's this profound like love and respect. And you know, the idea that we're so crazy and even harmful, but like so careful about only being harmful to ourselves, yeah, and not to others. Like there's you know, there's just there's no like misogyny, like homophobia, like there's just no like, it's all in such a good, like, wholesome spirit. And it's weird to call Jackass wholesome, but that's like genuinely how I see it. And it's something I'm super, super proud of.
Yeah. I think it goes back to the honesty. Like you're not trying to deceive anyone. And I think that's where it is different than pro wrestling, where the whole pretense behind pro wrestling is the deception. And here the whole pretense behind what you're doing is the honesty. Like, we have to believe that it's real because it is real, obviously. But that's the only way it's effective. As soon as people start thinking it's fake, it becomes Kenny versus Spenny. You know, it becomes something completely different.
Yeah, for sure, man.
Where did you kind of go? Like, obviously, you're hanging out with Logical Nonsense. Are you going to shows in New Mexico?
My other buddy, I wonder if, I mean, you're so into the, there's a somewhat smaller band called Word Salad.
Oh, shit, on Prank.
Word Salad was, those guys were my buddies too. Yeah, I went to see Logical Nonsense play, hell yeah, as well as Word Salad. And the drummer for Word Salad is my buddy Abe Towery. And I love that guy so much, man. I forgot another show I saw, DRI.
Yes.
I saw DRI at the Launch Pad in Albuquerque, as well as multiple Logical shows.
So the stuff in Albuquerque you're going to is a lot more crusty, you know, like, was that kind of the vibe you had at that point, or is it just kind of like you're friends with these dudes?
DRI was a band that I got into way back when I was 13.
Yeah. The more crossover.
Yeah, I was 13 years old. I got the album Dealing With It. By the time I was in Albuquerque, you got DRI seemed like old man.
Yeah.
I remember really feeling that way too. And come to think of it, like it was less than like 10 years into their tenure, you know. It's crazy how like time changes, man, as it goes by.
Hmm. Absolutely.
I don't know. And then there's another one, an incident I got while in Albuquerque. I was thrown out of a Kiss concert for blowing a fireball in the seats.
So you're already doing stuff like this by this
point.
Oh,
God,
right?
Yeah. Oh, hell yeah. Like, I moved to Albuquerque in 96. And, I dropped out of college, like, filming stunt videos in 93.
Yeah. What was your influence on doing that stuff at that point? Because that's pre-skate videos really having that kind of vibe to them.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, what led me to the video camera was the skateboard. And I ended up putting down the skateboard a little bit, but I kind of hung on to the video camera. Like when I went to college out of high school, I went to the University of Miami, and my whole vision was to, like, I was in the School of Communications, you know, I was specifically had a major in advertising, or at least I was seeking to have a major in advertising, because I thought the skateboard introduced me to the video camera, but I wasn't very good at skateboarding. So I was going to try to like become a creative advertising guy and make commercials or whatever. I just felt. And then I realized that saying going to class and making it through college wasn't really in the cards. So still kind of clinging to the video camera as, you know, my future one way or another, recognizing that I wasn't that good at skateboarding, I thought, all right, well, if I just did really dumb shit, you know, like really crazy stunts, then, and it was definitely modeled by like some of the antics, some of the just nonsense that would appear in skate videos. And as my career kind of like sprouted, I suppose, as it like germinated in the beginning, I made it my goal to provide comic relief and a breakup of the monotony of the skateboarding in skateboard videos. Cause that's like, even a skater can't watch just solid skating for an hour without losing their mind. Mm-hmm. And you know, from the beginning of skateboard videos, there was always something to break it up, you know, and I wanted to provide that. And then it turned out, when I was appearing in skateboard videos, that one of the, it was the Big Brother videos became like really quite wildly popular. And the guy in charge of making them, who's of course Jeff Tremaine, he reached out to Spike Jonze and he was like, yo, Spike, our Big Brother videos, you know, are really becoming popular. And I think if we take out the skateboarding, then just all the antics on their own could be a show. And how lucky did I get? Because I'm like, I really want to be a skater, but I'm just not that good. So I'll just settle for being in skateboard videos doing dumb shit. And then it was the dumb shit from the skateboard videos I was in that really resonated with a mainstream audience. And, well, and so, like, yeah, when they edited out the skateboarding from the Big Brother videos, all that was left over was Knoxville and me and Wee Man and Pontius. And it was just that simple. You know, it was just, I didn't do shit to become famous. All I did was try to get in skate videos.
Well, I love the idea, though, that then it goes around and it's just like recruiting the super group of people that are doing dumb shit on video. You know, like the people in the Pacific Northwest, the people that are in Pennsylvania doing it.
Right.
You know, even yourself that's in Florida, I guess, before this, like you guys are all coming together. And it's like sort of this sort of like Voltron of people willing to subject themselves to extreme violence. And I guess the only thing that's kind of likened to it around this time that's happening is performance art and deathmatch wrestling. Like, and obviously what you do is ultimately more extreme, but like, these are the two things that are kind of like closest to it in terms of what you subject yourselves to.
Yeah.
And Rose too, I guess. Circus Sideshow's also happen.
Yes. But I would even throw in like David Letterman's stupid human tricks, perhaps before I went to the Jim Rose.
Okay. Yeah.
But then again, I mean, I don't know, maybe not, you know, I think that, they probably much closer to it. What it was like America's Funniest Home Videos. You know, America's Funniest Home Videos was really like the very first, you know, sort of fail compilation.
Well, and you guys were almost like David Letterman's stupid human tricks, but like you're David Letterman at the same time as you're the person doing the stupid human trick. Like you're part of the joke as opposed to the punchline of the joke.
Right. Yeah.
In what you're doing, I guess. What was it like working with Umaga?
Oh, with Umaga? I mean, he was cool.
I watched that video of you going through that video again, and it is harrowing what he does to you. Like, I did a lot of stuff around pro wrestling, and it to send you in the ring like that without any training is.
Well, I mean, we walked through sort of what it would be. You know, like, I think I found myself in the dressing room of a band, and man, why can't I remember the name of this band? Oh, that'll make me go crazy. But it was really interesting. It was a jam band.
Yeah.
And my buddy's super into them. And so they were getting ready to, I'm now like, trying to
like Widespread Panic, like not Fish. Obviously that's,
yeah, it was a smaller,
Lettuce or whatever they're called, String Cheese in it.
I'm going to lose my mind. But whatever, like, they were, getting ready to do the show, and they were kind of just being like, okay, like we'll do this and then we'll do that. And then you go to that. And I felt like, wow, just being in their dressing room, watching them talk through what their plan was, and then knowing that they were just going to like sort of freestyle it. Yeah. I told them, I said, man, like you guys doing that reminds me of my match, at the WWE. Because, you know, it was like we kind of just kind of sort of walked through it, you know, like, okay, there's going to be this move. And then, you know, sort of the tent poles of the performance, like we're mm-hmm. just kind of agreed upon and you know, and then this will happen, that will happen. But you know, but that didn't speak to necessarily how it was going to play out as much. You know, we're just going to get from this point to that point to that point. And then the final move will be when Umaga jumps off the top rope and like they call it a splash, I think. And of course I didn't know that the match is not deemed finished if someone's still moving around.
They should have told you that. Like, you gotta stay down. Whatever you do, stay down.
I know. It was actually like kind of tragic, even, you know, to get to, there's no way out of it. And I don't think anybody necessarily knows how it ended, because you know, it got so dark with him just pummeling and beating me into a blackout that the broadcast stopped showing what was going on in the ring, and they just left him beating me in the ring and went to commercial. You know, like,
yeah,
they and I don't remember leaving the ring. So I don't have any inkling as to how that happened. And you know, that kind of head trauma is pretty gnarly.
I could only, you know, imagine what that was like to go through, because, you know,
and then I went home from there having been beaten into a blackout, and then I went home and inhaled like hundreds of cartridges of nitrous oxide.
Is that that photo?
No, that photo was when we were doing a shoot with Terry Richardson. I brought all of that to an actual photography set shoot.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's, I guess that's the other thing that you were, you know, you talk about that in the video, that you were pretty high that night, even at the WWE, yeah, kind of going through that. So I imagine that played into not being able to stay down.
Yeah, I suppose.
Yeah, it's a harrowing video to watch. And like you're saying, like, you know, the least they could have done is tell you to stay down. And that's the thing about wrestling. Unlike punk music, like, the real difference to me is the fact that to protect wrestling, you kind of have to do that. Like, you know, like, not saying that justifies what he did to you at all, but like, at the same time, like, that's what wrestlers do in order to protect their business. And it's, as soon as you get in the ring, it all bets are off. Like, they broke Hulk Hogan's leg when he went to try out the first time.
Oh yeah. Oh my God. Speaking of leg breaks, and not to put, you know, a frame of time on this podcast, but did you see last night, the dude in the UFC?
Oh no. My
God. It was seconds into a match, this guy, like, his name's Chris Weidman, throws a kick at his opponent, but he didn't, like, you're supposed to sort of hide a kick. You're supposed to throw a punch and then follow it with a kick, and he didn't do that. So he just, and so the opponent saw the kick coming and just sort of like checked it and like really stepped like down on it. Well, this guy, as the leg strikes, you know, the kicking leg just straight folds in half, dude. It folds in half. And the guy, not realizing that this happened, goes to try to stand on it.
Yeah.
Oh God. Fuck. That was even the harder part to watch. It was so fucking intense. Well, oh my God.
Well, I guess that's the other thing that's kind of happening just before Jackass, or just around Jackass, is those banned from TV tapes. And there's a scene like that with a kickboxer in one of those banned from TV tapes, which reminded me of them, where there was almost like this, like, precursor of stuff kind of happening, like backyard wrestling tapes being advertised on TV. Like, there's all this stuff.
And Too Hot for TV was a real thing, man.
Yeah, there
was,
exactly.
Backyard wrestling. There was Caught on Tape, or like, I mean, it was almost like early 2000s iteration of Faces of Death, where like, you see someone walking in front of a train and then it just stops. Like, we can't show you this on TV. I figured out the name of that jam band. It was Spafford.
I would have never gotten that. So good.
Pretty small band from Florida, but really cool guys.
Well, that's the thing about what you're describing. Like, those tapes, like Faces of Death, even, like, those videos are something that, you know, like, like people are drawn to. Like those things sold millions and millions of copies, and what you guys did was still provide, you know, that level of thrill, voyeuristic kind of like horror show for the audience, but take out the death and the lack of consent that's in those videos.
Yeah, right.
And it really does provide, like, it's amazing talking to Darby Allin, like, you're his biggest influence. Like, it's not necessarily even the wrestlers that he
that kid is so rad.
Yeah.
Darby Allin, man. I mean, I worry about him, and I'm like just genuinely in awe of him, man. I mean, Jesus.
Yeah. No, he's definitely on, I don't think I've met too many people like him, you know, like his just singularity in what he's trying to do. And it's scary because I've seen him. Oh my God. Some of the stuff I saw him do, like, it's just, it really is kind of like on another level, but it's very much inspired by what you guys do.
Yeah. It's intense. It's, yeah. What was the, how did you end up getting Darby Allin?
I did a documentary series for Vice called The Wrestlers. And it was a series of 10 documentaries looking at wrestling as an art form. So we went to Japan and looked at strong style wrestling at Lucha Libre. And we went to the Congo and saw Witch Catch, which is Bokoko based wrestling where they wrestle in the streets for free. And the wrestlers are all witches and they perform magic in the ring against their opponents. And it's huge. It's ginormous how many people are there. And this one woman, her finishing move is she castrates and eats her opponent's a penis in the ring. And
wow. It is
the most insane thing I've ever seen. And she left the ring with the penis in her mouth and the knife. And it was like she pulled out a gun. The crowd was reacting like she like it was just unreal.
So what? And that was, that's just like fake or what?
Yeah, it's a gimmick. It's a gimmick. And then the whole thing is that she can restore the person's penis. But the thing about wrestling there is it kind of crosses the line where it's almost like, well, it is religion. Like these people are religious practitioners. Like you wrestle for free in order to demonstrate your power as a witch. So you get hired to perform rituals for people outside of the ring. Like it's really... it is religion.
Yeah. Crazy,
it's,
man.
It's fascinating. But like, anyway, so Darby was one of the, we did a episode all about Evolve Pro Wrestling, which is where Darby kind of got discovered, I guess, originally. And three wrestlers that were wrestling for them and kind of being groomed to become stars. And actually all three of them kind of moved on to bigger things, but Darby certainly has, like even meeting him then, we're like, oh, this guy's got something special. And they shattered his elbow in the middle of a match with a shovel.
Damn.
The first day we were shooting with him, and actually the first day we were shooting with him, he fell off a ladder and got a giant goose egg and thought he was bleeding internally and had to go to the hospital. And the second time we shot with him, they shattered his elbow and then put him in a body bag full of thumbtacks and threw him around the ring. And and you know, after talking to him, he was like, yeah, like I used to submit videos to MTV of me just doing insane shit, you know. And it's very much like your progeny. Like, this is what you guys begat.
You know, when Jackass first came out and it said on the screen, the first thing, you know, they said, we do not accept videotape submissions, so don't even bother sending them. I remember thinking, like, well, I mean, nobody would know where to send it. Maybe you could send it to MTV, but that's not going to get to us, you know, like, and I remember thinking, like, let me go on the internet and say, hey, dude, like, send them to me. You know, like I wanted to solicit videotapes and put out a DVD called Children of the Beast, Attempts at Being on Jackass. You know, like, and I thought that was, in hindsight, I don't think that was, it would even be that great. But
well, it did kind of happen, right? MTV had like three or four different shows that weren't even like spinoffs, like not counting the stuff you guys actually did, but like just like guys from Scotland doing it. There was, I think, a group of
Australia.
Like they really did kind of franchise out this idea.
Yeah, they had there's some guys from not Scotland, but guys from Wales.
Wales, sorry, that's very offensive for me to confuse the two. Sorry, Wales.
Right, and what was it? They were called Dirty Sanchez. In England, they were called Dirty Sanchez, but Dirty Sanchez being like a particularly naughty reference. They in America, they called them Team Sanchez.
Team Sanchez, that's right.
Because what they were doing was fine, but what they called themselves was not.
No, that's where you have to draw the line. That's really where it goes too far.
And I think that with a lot of these sort of, you know, shows or ensembles that like that, I think the Dirty Sanchez guys like kind of tripped over themselves a little bit, like in maybe taking it too seriously. I don't know, because I didn't really see anything too much, but I think that what made Jackass kind of work better was a bit more lightheartedness and lightheartedness, and we're able to kind of not take anything too seriously.
Well, yeah, and like it's like lightning in a bottle charisma that you all have, you know, and that's the thing that you need, because like we need to love the people that are suffering to make it work. Like that's where it's also like wrestling, like where you're kind of manipulating the audience in the sense that we need to love you, and we need to think that this is a fun time to make that pain acceptable. And like, yeah, very few other people that are doing this seem to catch that.
Yeah, man. Well, it's a lot of fun, dude. So what number podcast is this for you?
335, I think.
Wow. And you put it up every week?
I put up 2 a week now. I could put up about 3 probably. There's a lot of demand to be on it, weirdly.
Nice, been, dude. I mean, I saw it, like some of your previous guests really impressed me, man.
Well, it goes to show, and like having you on and hearing you talk about fucking Gut Instinct. Like I opened for Gut Instinct, I guess it'd be close to 10 years ago, or I played with them. And at that show, I never in my life thought I'd be talking to Steve-O about a Gut Instinct years later.
Yeah, they're fucking good, man. They're really good.
But that's the weird thing is like, you know, it just keeps connecting different worlds, you know, and we're all weirdly connected. Like you were saying earlier, like we're drawn to it because I think we're all searching for something and we're all lonely.
I'm interested. You said you did a show with them 10 years ago, but they wouldn't have put out any new material for like over 20 years, right?
No, it
like,
was the 7-inch reissue show when they played in Baltimore. It was us, this band Cold World, and the Cro-Mags.
Dude, the Cro-Mags, dude, how did I forget about them? My bro John Joseph.
Yeah.
yeah, I love that guy.
Did you ever see them back in the day?
I didn't, but I was turned on to them in 93. So that was almost as a little bit of a soundtrack of me failing and dropping out of the University of Miami.
Were you going to shows when you were in Miami?
Not anything that you'd be particularly interested in. And mostly I was just trying to get fucked up.
Yeah.
And we didn't talk too much about death metal, but Deicide was that, and you know, came in. I really became a big fan of Deicide, and I feel like there's a caveat to that. I like Deicide when when Glenn Benton is articulating his words just a little bit more than ooh, you know, like. I get, and boy, did I step in it when I went to a Cannibal Corpse show in, I believe, 2007. And, you know, they're like, they brought me into the dressing room immediately after these guys got off stage. They're covered in sweat. They just got off stage. It's like, oh, yeah, you know, like, and, you know, meeting the guy, I don't know which guy, one of the guys. And I said, dude, like, I said, oh, man, dude, I really want to love you guys, but I can't make out fucking anything you're saying, and I feel excluded. Like, I feel excluded. You know, I want to know what's so evil about what you're saying. I can't understand a fucking word. And it was not what you say to those guys, particularly not when they just got off stage.
No. That's awesome. How did you get into Big Brother magazine? Like, was it just through skateboarding? Because it was such an interesting magazine.
Yeah, oh my God, it was so great. It was while I was living in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Again, I moved there in 96. Only lived there for, 2.5 years? Mm-hmm. And I loved it, man. I just loved it so much. And then Big Brother was coming through town on a Duff's Shoes tour. And I just made it my mission to track them down. I mean, it was a pretty small skate scene. It wasn't going to be too tough to find them. And when I did find them, you know, it was Dimitri. And I told him, basically, I was like, dude, you guys are going to fucking put me in the magazine. Dude, I fucking love you guys, man. I'm fucking put me in there. The message is sort of like, I don't care if you like me, but you are going to include me in the pages of your magazine. And, you know, that night everybody wound up at a keg party. And this is where I did my fire stunt with the pro skater for Duff's, Chris Markovich. And it was sort of, I light my head on fire. He blows a fireball off of my head, you know, my flaming hair being the torch. And I've got my hands doused in alcohol, which I stick into the fireball that's coming off my head. So now my hand's on fire as well as my head. And then I'm going to do a simultaneous fire breathing backflip, like with my own mouth, about like all in one crazy sequence. But the sequence began with Chris Markovich blowing the fireball like point blank into my face. So from my shoulder up, like shoulders up, my whole fucking face is on fire.
Yeah.
And my best thinking in that moment was, I better hurry up and do this backflip. So I do a fire breathing backflip with my whole fucking face on fire. And I come up short. So I land on my knees. So that sort of like precludes me from being able to put my face out as you know, because I'm like kind of laid out on the ground. And I get up and I'm like just flailing through the backyard, like my fucking face on fire, and was hospitalized with second degree burns on half my face. And I got published in Big Brother, and that was that was how I was introduced to really the skateboard community, but more importantly, the people behind Big Brother.
Is that one of the bonus features on that first DVD, I think?
It wasn't my first DVD that I ever put out. It just played like a regular scene. It's Don't Try This at Home, Steve-O DVD.
Yeah. Yeah. That is, those remain some of the most, especially the tour DVD. The next one. Those are like unlike any band tour documentary ever. Like there's nothing like that for a road movie.
I think it's fair to say. I think that I would even say that where I dished out all of this praise for Jackass being wholesome on some level, the wholesomeness, you know, didn't transfer over to my tour DVDs. that reverence and respect for others really kind of was checked at the door when I went on tour.
There's like recently Jenny, who sings in the band Savages, was on the show, and she talked about this idea of living in your art, like in sort of Cassavetes as a filmmaker, and the idea of him living in his art. He was not living in his art anywhere close to the way you were living in your art.
Yeah. I mean, hey dude, I've thought many times over the years that third DVD, which was called Out on Bail.
Yes.
Which represented the first 6 months of the year 2003. And like I've thought many times, like, fuck, if I could just live 6 months of my life on a loop forever, which is a fucked up thing for a guy who, you know, like an alcohol drug addict who's in recovery to even think. But I can't help it, man. That fucking that was the time of my life, dude.
Well, and the reality is you can't relive them, right? So that's the, that's the, I guess, the healthy thing about having that memory.
Right. Yeah. And it wasn't even like, I just remember it like it's like this. I romanticize it and I shouldn't because it really, you know, there's just a lot wrong with that whole period.
And well, I guess that's the disservice once again about that documentary is the fact that, you know, here I am watching it and it looks, you know, it looks wild and out of control, but it also, I don't see the probably really dark times that also came along with that period of your life.
I mean, I don't know. When I say there's a lot wrong with it, like, I was being really taken advantage of in a business sense, you know, like I didn't fucking care. I mean, back then I thought I'm going to be dead anyway. Like I don't need, I just wasn't responsible about stuff. And I just wanted to get footage because that could still play after I died, you know?
Yeah.
And so to look back on it, like the amount of money that was being generated and that I never saw any of, I mean, I don't really need, you know, I don't hold a grudge over it or anything now, but I just look back on it like, wow, you know, it was just a different time. It was a different time. And for me, like having ended up getting sober and you know, like becoming on in some way, like a healthy person. Now I'm confronted with the scary possibility or even probability that, you know, I'm perhaps only middle-aged, you know, like, fuck, I'm like the idea of, fuck, you know, for all the fear of death out there, like fear of living for a long, long fucking time is what I suffered from, I think. And so now I'm like in this crazy, you know, try to get organized, try to get, you know, motivated, try to really be productive. And, you know, because the idea of living for a long time, like, that makes me feel like I really need to be much more clever about my resources and more specifically my finances.
Well, I guess that's really like, once again, like how it comes back to what it's like similar to pro wrestling in that way that you're, it's like a Faustian deal with fame that you have where you're paying for it with your body.
Sort of, yeah. I mean, I've evolved enough that I still do super reckless shit, and boy, am I getting ready to do. I'm putting together a whole show. I don't know when I'll start because I still have the bucket list one that I told you about. But
yeah,
once the bucket list runs its course, and then I put that special out, I already know that my next one is called "Gone Too Far." Where, and I don't know what that's going to really paint me into a corner, but I've got it all pretty mapped out.
Do you think you'll ever be able to give it up and like walk away from it? Is there like an exit strategy? Like, obviously you're a massive, cultural figure outside of just what you do in terms of stunts, but like in the way that
it's a great idea. I mean, it's a great question. And it's, you know, I consider myself, everything that drives me has always been an overdeveloped need for attention. Like clearly, whether it's Jackass stuff, whether it's, you know, stand-up comedy, like anything that I do, like, it's scary, the idea of being an attention whore, in middle age, because clearly getting old is a fucking major party foul, which really offends people. You know, like there's something built into the human condition, which is like a fear of mortality, you know, like nobody, I mean, in Eastern cultures, it's not like as big of a deal, but in the Western world, like nobody even wants to contemplate their mortality.
No.
Just definitely. Fucking blinders on. You know, I would say that in you know, probably a really large portion of the population of America would not know what the definition of hospice is.
Yeah.
You know, like, let alone, like, you know, when people get old, like, just put them in a fucking nursing home. I don't want to see them. And I don't want to know where the nursing home is. You know, it's kind of like the whole mentality, because old people are a reminder of our mortality, and we don't want to think about our mortality. So we don't even want to fucking look at old people, you know? And so that's why getting old is so scary to me, because it represents like being ostracized. It represents being a walking fucking party foul. And to be trapped in that situation with a crazy hunger for attention is like the ultimate fucking scary idea. You know, like, I need to be the center of attention, yet nobody wants to pay attention to me because I'm a reminder of their mortality. Like, fuck, that scares the shit out of me. So one way or another, I got to figure out how to evolve out of the attention whore business. And I think that like what got me kind of on that path a little bit, first off, was just, you know, getting into 12-step recovery. You know, that hasn't gotten me out of the attention whore business in any fashion. But what it has done is helped me to sort of draw a line between the persona of Steve-O and, you know, my personal life. You know, in my personal life, I'm the most boring fucking asshole you could possibly imagine. You know, like, and I love that. You know, so I've got some separation. You know, I've got my character, and I've got like who I really am. And just now, like, I'm starting to work on you know, things to do and the feel. Like, for example, right now, I'm sitting in a warehouse facility that I've rented. It's a fulfillment center. You know, this is where I've got a warehouse with all the merch. I've got a warehouse staff, and we fulfill all the orders coming in from my online store. And gradually, we're starting to take on other clients, and so that like gives us the potential to expand and expand and expand, and ultimately, I could be. You know, in the shipping business,
yeah.
You know, who knows? Like, I've also got a bit of a budding career as a tattoo artist. I've been giving tattoos, and actually, within the next 9 minutes, my tattoo guru is coming over, so I can drill some ink into him.
Is it Rollins?
No. It's I'm sort of doing a very unconventional apprenticeship. Like, these are ways out for me as I see it, you know. And like, even stand-up comedy is a little bit of like sort of a weaning, you know, like you can kind of do stand-up comedy as a pretty old guy. You can do podcasts, I think, so I'm evolving in ways, but yeah, this whole middle age and getting old thing scares the fuck out of me, and that's the kind of the premise for this new book that I'm working on.
Well, that's the thing about wrestlers, is they never walk away, right? Like, look at Ric Flair, look at Terry Funk, look at all these guys that, you know, you can't walk away, even though, cause it's something, cause it is your art, you know, like, even though you'd pay for it with your body, and even though it does, you know, it is an art form that you've kind of committed your life to at a certain point. And like, you know, it's very hard for like a painter to stop painting or a musician to stop making music. And I think much in the same way, it must be difficult for you to stop doing what you've done.
Yeah, for sure. And I imagine athletes, poor fuckers.
Yeah.
You know,
absolutely.
But yeah, in any case, man, you know, we go on and we figure it out as we go. And like, I think that the out of everything, you know, if I just described this, like this crippling fear of getting old and everything. And it's like, that's it's so stupid that whenever I get caught up in fear, like what's up, dog? The question is, you know, where's my faith in all this, man? You know, What the fuck is everything is the way it's supposed to be. And everything's going to be fucking fine. You know, and it's like we're alive in this body on this earth to have a good time with it, man. So I got to learn how to fucking lay back and get ready to be an old fucker and enjoy everything. And with that, I got a jam because actually I got a surprise visit from my good buddy Bam.
Well, Steve-O, this has been incredible. Thank you so much for taking the time. And anytime you want to come back here and talk more punk rock, I got a lot more questions and art in general. You're always welcome.
Well, hey, man, I appreciate you, Damien. And again, sorry for flaking on you the last time. And it's been a pleasure, man.
Thank you, Steve-O, for coming on the show. And Gut Instinct to Word Salad. That's my ideal mixtape right there. Don't forget to check out stevo.com for Gnarly, his new special, because my God, does this man suffer for our enjoyment. And he will be hopefully be back for a part two if he survives all these things, because there's a lot more places for us to go down the road in the future. And speaking of down the road in the future, on the next episode of this show, we're going somewhere completely different. Coming up on the next episode, Pat Flynn from the band Fiddlehead and, of course, Have Heart will be joining me on the show. And he's one of the coolest people in hardcore. And we have a really fun conversation. And I am very excited for you to hear it. And that's that. Remember, as always, Black Lives Matter. The lives of Indigenous people matter. We need to protect trans kids. And we need to help trans people protect themselves. And we also need to stop hate and violence towards Asian people. Go out there right now, get informed, get involved, show up, sign petitions, just lend support, educate yourself, just smash fascism. You know, these aren't political issues. These are just like human rights issues. So just, you know, support people being free, you know, and just living their lives. People just want to live their lives. Speaking of living your life, live your best life by putting something out there creatively in this world. Create your own culture. Start a band, start a fanzine, start a podcast. You know, just do something. It'll help your mental health. You know, maybe just draw a picture or something for yourself. I tried meditating recently. That's helping me mentally as well. So maybe that'll work for you. I didn't think it was going to work. And it works. It works. You know, maybe this exercise thing. I'm going to try that next, I think. And probably not. Probably not. Sign your organ donor cards, because by the time they come looking for those things, you're not going to need them. You'll just be like, get them out of here. I'm dead. I don't need these. Give these to someone else and maybe it'll help them. And wear a mask, get vaccinated if you can, and we'll get back to playing shows and being in shows soon. You know, I can't wait. Can't wait to see everyone. All right. I love you. Stay safe. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.